Support for this show comes from PicMonkey.com. Since 1738, PicMonkey.com has been the preferred photo editor for everyone from George Washington to your friend with that cool blog. And guess what? Me too. I used it lots of times. It's fantastic. So whether you're editing photos or creating collages, you can make great stuff with PicMonkey. And now you, yes you, can have a free trial of PicMonkey's premium service. It's a heaping mega spoon of bonus features, and it costs money for everybody but you. Just go to picmonkey.com/undisclosed.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of The Addendum. This is Colin Miller, Associate Dean and Professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law and Blogger Evidence Prof. I'm joined by Susan Simpson, attorney at the Volkoff Law Group and blogger at The View from LL2. Robbie is taking the week off to celebrate the end of Ramadan. Following up on last week's episode, Susan had a chance to talk to Chris Floor, one of Adnan's initial attorneys. As we discussed in episode 7, we think that the decision to deny Adnan bail in this case played a large role in the ultimate outcome of that case. And Susan, when you talked to Chris, what did he have to say?
Well, I talked to him a lot about bail in general in Baltimore and its importance, not just in Adnan's case, but in general, how it's such a crucial issue for so many trials and how the system itself, in many ways, is about as poorly designed as it could be. And he shared with me what he'd experienced as an attorney in Baltimore and what he saw were the major problems with the current bail system. So can you tell me who you are and what your role was in Adnan's case?
Sure. My name's Chris Floor, and I was one of two lawyers handling Adnan's case back at its inception. I was working on a grant-funded project called The Lawyers at Bail, and I was the legal director of the Lawyers at Bail project. Professor Doug Colbert was the actual director and got the grant funding and oversaw all the operations. So Doug got hired to handle Adnan's case, brought me in. The both of us were representing him at the earliest stages of the cases. I mean, I was literally down at the police station when they were interrogating Adnan. And as I've said publicly before, it just blew my mind that his family had hired us. I had asked for access to him, and he had no idea that I was outside, and the police absolutely forbid me and prohibited me from having any access to him and invoked what's, at least at the time, I haven't researched the issue since then, but at the time it was a Supreme Court precedent that said that unless the defendant specifically themselves asked for counsel, the officers were under no obligation to allow me in, and there would be no way that he would have known I was sitting outside, literally standing outside the police station in the rain, trying to get buzzed in. It was just so exceedingly frustrating that coming from a different jurisdiction, I had just moved less than a few months ago from New York, where I had practiced for 8 years as a legal aid lawyer in Brooklyn, New York. And there, the practice and in the New York City area was if a lawyer, whether they were a public defender attorney or a private attorney, called up a police officer or detective, they would stop questioning immediately once they knew that we were in. But that was not so in Charm City.
Is that a common thing you've encountered in Maryland?
I haven't had it come up on a lot of occasions, but I can tell you that my practice changed after then, and nobody leaves my office without a letter. If they're under investigation and they might possibly be questioned by the police, nobody leaves without a letter that is signed by them so that they are, in fact, requesting an attorney immediately. The discovery process at the bail stage, which I spent probably a little bit over a year, I guess we had the bail project going. So I was in court every day supervising lawyers, handling bail hearings myself. And during this time, Adnan's case was sort of percolating up from district court to circuit court, where he ultimately went to trial. And so I got to see hundreds and hundreds of bail hearings myself, conduct a number of them. And it was mind-blowing when I first moved here that there could be a right to counsel, but yet no one representing someone at that stage. And even within some of the defense community, that they were not thinking that this was really a big deal. And coming from my experience in Brooklyn, judges basically were of a sort that they wouldn't want to hear from somebody who is unrepresented. I can see in my mind's eye many times in the courts of Brooklyn how when a defendant who was unrepresented would start to speak and the judge would say, stop, you don't have a lawyer. You don't want to be talking to me. I don't want to hear from you. And I was in for a pretty big culture shock when I came here with the 10-day rule for the public defenders, which many, many defendants miss that 10-day requirement. I've seen a number of them go to trial without a lawyer because they went in on the 9th day as opposed to the 10th day asking for a lawyer, and the courts, you know, denied a postponement.
What's the 10-day rule?
So the public defenders had required, I don't know if this is still the case, I can't say I can remember it within the past year seeing it, but so I've been in state about 17 years now, and what would happen is the folks were told when they got out of jail that they needed to apply 10 business days before their court date. And if they didn't do that, if they came in on the 9th day before their trial date, the public defender's office would say you didn't meet the regulation that we need to see you in advance. So you'll have to ask for a postponement and come back to us. If your postponement's granted, then we'll screen you to determine whether we'll represent you. And seeing people on a routine basis, where I would hear a judge in the district court and sometimes the circuit court say, you know, well, you didn't apply for counsel, so I'm denying your request to have this case postponed. You're going to go to trial today without a lawyer. It was just mind-blowing for me. And on the plus side, I have to say that my experience in New York was I didn't really work with judges. We were sort of looking at them as the enemy. Mm-hmm. And the Bail Project became a really collaborative process where I was in chambers very frequently. We got a lot of access thanks to the administrative judge and the other judges that were there in both the Wabash and North Avenue courthouses, which is where bail reviews were held at the time solely, and for district court. And that was really a great experience for me because I learned that there's an assumption on lawyers' parts that judges know everything, you know, that they can handle a landlord-tenant case and know the law inside and out on Tuesday and then on a Thursday know everything there is to know about the rules of bail, the mm-hmm. statutes, the constitutional arguments and so forth. And it's just, you know, it's really not fair to assume that someone could know that. And it's on us to be able to teach them. And not every judge was welcoming our desire to teach, but many were. And we made a difference. I mean, one of the things that I can point with pride that, you know, this group of lawyers, there was probably about 25 of us at one point. It varied, you know, with the number of lawyers that we had on staff, that, you know, we really started getting judges to in Baltimore anyway, to issue a 10% bond. And we just thought it was absurdity to enrich this huge industry of bail bondsmen, and driving through this, you know, the different corners of Baltimore and seeing like a tiny, tiny beat up house and having a huge bail bond mm-hmm. sign out of it in a very poor neighborhood, and seeing the, you know, multiple pages in the Yellow Pages at the time, which was the desired, you know, way of advertising, how many folks were competing for this business. And simply because there was no lawyer there to tell a judge, hey, could you set a 10% as opposed to a regular bond, then it wasn't happening. And some judges didn't even know about what that meant. We had to point out where there was in the rules for them. And it makes a huge difference in a case, particularly in a family where so much of what drives the criminal justice system, and it really doesn't apply in Adnan's case, I suppose maybe tangentially, but in terms of him as a criminal defendant, he's certainly not the typical defendant that comes through. But in typical folks, we're dealing with poverty, we're dealing with drug abuse, alcohol abuse, mental illness. Those are the biggies. Mm-hmm. And for a person who's abusing drugs or alcohol, they've often cost their families a tremendous amount of money. So if they're qualifying for private counsel, or even if they have the public defender, it really doesn't matter, the difference between posting 10% and being able to get that money back when the person returns to court versus paying that 10% to a bail bondsman and losing it, you know, forever is huge. And I've had, you know, more than one case in my career where the family said, I will not post the bail bond. If you can get the judge to set a 10%, I will post that and make sure my loved one comes back. So,
yeah, in D.C., we did away with.
Yeah, you guys have definitely done some great reform that, you know, we'll see how that comes. There was tremendous work by a bail task force in Maryland, and it was under our previous governor. And sadly, a lot of the recommendations, one of which was to do away with money bail, have just sort of been shelved by this administration. And it's still early, so I'm an optimist. I'm hoping that they can look at the hard work that those is a very diverse group of people and that task force did for a very long time. And, you know, I can get it where the undisclosed is a great tool. And I'm so grateful that, you know, that it's doing what it's doing for Adnan and beyond. It's not just helping, you know, his individual case and shine the light on his case, but it's also showing, you know, how much work needs to go into everybody, all the different sides, the law enforcement, the defense bar, the judges, the prosecutors, you know, to get justice in a case. And some people may say, if they're listening to this interview, say, oh, gosh, how much longer are we going to listen to this guy about bail? But it's really a critical, critical part of a case. And, you know, it's always been something that I've challenged judges over time, say, how can you tell my client that he's got a presumption of innocence, yet keep him in on a no bond and not have any hope that he can get back, you know, to court and under no circumstance. And I get it that some of my clients have put judges in awkward positions, you know, where they'll have multiple warrants and so forth, homeless people, those kind of clients are difficult. I once had a judge in district court challenge me that he would, he's since passed away, God rest his soul, but he challenged me that he would release my client if I agreed to take my client into my house because he was homeless. It gets a little crazy sometimes, but it really is a very, very important issue because until you're on the receiving end of it, and this I find, you know, every criminal defense lawyer gets the question, which is what we call it, the question, you know, how could you knowingly represent those people, guilty people, people who've done horrible things and so forth. And it's not until a family or a person themselves gets on the receiving end of the justice system and they realize that a judge has the power and based on a very, very short hearing that could last literally 30 seconds to deny your ability to be released while the case is pending. And that there's, you know, unless you get another judge to overturn that, you're stuck. And certainly in homicide cases, it's more the norm that either a very high bail or no bond is set. But I can tell you from, you know, clients I have represented on homicide charges that did get released, that it's not a foregone conclusion that they're going to disappear. And when we talk about the costs of the criminal justice system and how much pretrial detention costs, and this is one of the things that the Bail Project work and the work I've done since then has taught me, is that I thought that the corrections folks were sort of on the side of keeping the status quo, but they're some of the most vocal people. And if you look at the task force reports and so forth, in particular, the representatives from the Baltimore City jail system were very vocal about there are certain people that I don't want to have in my jail. You know, this person who's seriously mentally ill, you know, who's got a minor charge, who's sitting in on a $200 bail that can't make $200 to pay. I don't want that person here. You don't want me to have that person and keep them there for a month, 45 mm-hmm. days or longer. And all that time to be able to spend and cost is just, it's just ludicrous.
There were, I believe, in the month after Anand's arrest, two bail hearings. Were mm-hmm. you present at both of those?
I was present at both of them. You would think I'd have the better memory of the second one, which is the circuit court hearing. I believe that was in front of Judge Nance, but actually have a very, very vivid recollection of the district court hearing, which happened at Wabash Avenue before Judge Hargrove. And we had unprecedented family support in this case. You know, I have certainly beaten the bushes in the past, made the phone calls, had other family members try to get people to come out and support. But the outpouring of support was just so overwhelming in Adnan's case. Literally, school bus fulls of people came into the parking lot, and virtually every square inch of the Wabash District Court hallways and places for the general public to be was literally covered up by folks that were there to support Adnan. There was no way possible that they could have all fit in the courtroom that day. And I recall that at the time, the state's attorneys were not appearing on any bail cases except cases where there was a serious charge. Typically, that was a murder case. And there was a prosecutor in at the district court bail hearing. And that's when some of the beginning seeds that you've heard that have been, you know, sort of came out later on in the case were starting to get planted. The reason why, you know, bail is such an important issue is that it changes so many things in the case. And that is that it changes your ability to investigate. It changes your ability to develop mitigation. Even though, you know, Judge Hurd ultimately sentenced Adnan to, you know, what I believe is an excessive sentence, the fact that he was incarcerated all that time denied him of the ability to show her, you know, what he actually was as a human being and as a person, because he was now in a very foreign environment where his ability to continue with his schooling, to continue with all of his life while the case was pending was just completely obliterated. So that's one thing. Investigation is huge. The other thing is that psychologically, I'm sure some judges and prosecutors will debate me on this, but I can tell you that, you know, there's something about the physics principle of a body at rest tends to remain at rest. Well, if you're incarcerated, it's much easier to keep you incarcerated than it is to do something differently. So when you're inside, no matter how hard they want to hide the fact that someone's incarcerated and the jury not be able to see the handcuffs and to see the jumpsuit and so forth, virtually every jury that defense lawyers speak to, they'll tell you that when we get a chance to speak to jurors, that they knew that the person was in. And it's hard for that not to prejudice a case. I mean, we're trying to do all these things to be able to get the fairest trial we possibly humanly can. And this is one of those things that's always concerned me when someone goes to trial. If a person enters a guilty plea, of course, the consequences with the prejudice before a jury is certainly not there. But between the investigation and just the ability in resolving the case, that it's just much more difficult to be able to get a non-jail disposition.
There's also the fact, despite that, after 6 to 10 hours, depending when they started interrogation, he said nothing. Is that something you've seen often, to have a witness or had a defendant under questioning for that long and not give up anything that's incriminating?
I think that is not the norm. And where so much of the system and the intimidation factor sets in, that if he had something incriminating to give, the likelihood would have been, particularly at that age. I mean, my reaction to hearing Serial for the first time, and I hadn't heard Adnan's voice in about 10 or 15 years, something like that. I was sad. When I first heard his voice, and I find it interesting that a lot of people would say, you know, oh, well, you know, how could he have done this? He's such a well-spoken person. And I still believe Adnan's a well-spoken person, but there was definitely a street tone that overtook him in the system that he categorically did not have when I met him when he was 17 years old. This was a kid. This was a kid. So it's a good thing to see this discussion now where people are asking, well, why are people sitting in jail on a bail that they can't make? And if we're professing to be able to say that we have an equal justice system, which everybody that's involved with it knows that it's not ever been, nor will it likely ever really fully be, but it's something that we have to continue to aspire to. And now, you know, with folks sitting in on $100 bail, a $200 bail, you know, no sane person would forfeit their liberty for $200 or $100. That just means that they can't afford to pay it. And that just can't be something that we tolerate.
To start off the Twitter questions this week, we have a question from Ray Amari, whose Twitter handle is @SchizoDancer. She writes, exactly how did Mr. S chance upon Hay's body if it was really buried? Well, we've touched on Mr. S before, but there's a lot more going on with this story, and it's worth looking into in greater detail. But I'm pretty firmly convinced, and I believe Colin and Rabia agree with me on this one, that it's very unlikely that Mr. S just chanced upon the body, like he said at trial.
Yeah, we can start that with why he was taking the route he was taking on February 9th. And so Mr. S worked at Coppin State. That's a university in Baltimore. He lived to the west of Coppin State. And when he was going to Lincoln Park, he was traveling west to east on Franklintown Road. First question is, why was he on Franklintown Road? That route takes about 19 minutes. He could have taken another road, Windsor Mill Road, that only took about 13 to 14 minutes. More importantly, though, is, as I said, he's traveling west to east. So he is on the right, the south side of the road when he gets to the area of Lincoln Park where Hay is buried. And Susan, you've been there, right? And so Hay's body is buried on the north side of Franklintown Road, right?
Yes, on the opposite side of the road that Mr. S was traveling on, according to his story. So to believe him, he's driving back from his home, suddenly has to go to the bathroom very, very urgently. And rather than pull off on the right side of the road, which would be more convenient and more normal, he decides to actually somehow back across the westbound lane of traffic into a little pull-off area on the north side, where he ultimately goes into the woods and finds Hay's body, which I suppose he could have done. It's, you know, stranger things have happened. But logistically, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, because this was a pretty well-trafficked road with two-way traffic and a double yellow line. So for him to do that, it seems risky when he simply could have pulled over to the south side of the road, gone into the woods to the south, and relieved himself there.
I mean, that's even taking the whole story about him needing to go that urgently seriously, which in itself is a pretty tenuous story too. So I guess for me, it's when you start piling on all these tenuous possible actions Mr. S could have taken. The odds that he would take this sequence of events just doesn't, I don't buy it.
Yeah, and that's part of that story about the urination that's weird if we look to what Mr. S said. We have the notes from his statement on February 9th. And the statement reads, stated he almost fell over body. It was right beside him when he started to urinate. And when he initially testifies at trial as well, he also testifies that he started urinating before he saw the body. But then he changes his story on cross-examination where he says, well, no, I actually never urinated. And so again, we have these inconsistencies. Did he start peeing? Did he never pee? It's really strange because his story takes this drastic turn over time and we're not exactly sure what's going on. Susan, you were there at the site. Does that make sense that he almost fell over the body?
Well, I don't see how he could have almost fallen over the body because the tree was in the way. I guess he could have almost fallen over both the tree and the body. I mean, I just have a hard time taking this seriously. What he says doesn't fit with reality.
I mean, he's basically pretty close to Coppin State at the time that he pulls over. Why not just drive to Coppin State and do his business there?
And even the whole idea of going home to get a plane. I mean, sure, it's possible Coppin State didn't have one. It's possible he had a plane that he really loved using and wanted to make sure to use his own tool instead of the ones the school had. But Mr. S also says that the work order that the plane was needed for came in a few days before, and that he just decided this day to fix it. I mean, why not wait another day and bring it with him to work, rather than making a separate trip at lunchtime?
Yeah, and this is part of the story that bothers me the most. You mentioned the plane. So Mr. S's story is, he works in the maintenance department at Coppin State. He gets a work order to shave down a door using a plane, which is a tool that's used to shave off wood on doors, windows, etc. And he says that Coppin State, it's an older school. They have a lot of wood doors and windows that swell due to age and precipitation. And yet his claim is Coppin State doesn't have a plane, the tool that's used. So he goes home, and that's what eventually leads to him driving through Lincoln Park and discovering the body. And according to Mr. S at trial, that was the only reason he went home. He had his lunch at school. He didn't go home to have lunch. But this comes up during cross-examination. He made a statement to Detective Ritz, and we're not entirely sure. It's tough to say the sequence, but here is clearly a statement that Detective Ritz is asking about. And during that time, you did not indicate that you'd gone home to retrieve any type of tool for work. You just stated that you'd gone home to have lunch. You didn't make any mention of having a 22-ounce beer, a Budweiser, or taking that beer back into your vehicle, consuming it while on your way to work. And you, Mr. S, answered yes. So, yeah, I mean, Susan, I'm not sure about when this statement came, but at least at one point in time, Mr. S is saying, I didn't go home to get a tool or anything. I was getting lunch, which is completely inconsistent with his trial testimony.
Yeah, I wish we had that document to see what else he said in the interview.
Well, I was going to say, he's not even consistent about the beer. So according to Mr. S, when he goes home, in addition to getting the plane, he gets this 22-ounce bottle of Budweiser. In one statement, he says he drinks basically the whole thing and throws it out the window. In another statement, he says, I drank about half the bottle and then threw out the half full bottle out the window.
Yeah, and if the cops had wanted to verify his story, which they didn't, they could have talked to Mr. S's stepson and his girlfriend, who were allegedly at home when Mr. S came home for this lunchtime trip. I guess my theory is that this trip never happened. I don't think Mr. S actually went home on February 9th, 1999. It seems to me more likely that whenever and however he discovered the body, that had already occurred. And February 9th was just the day that he decided to report it. Another reason to think that Mr. S might not have seen the body on February 9th, but had instead seen it on an earlier date, comes from his interview with the police, in which he described how, after walking back into the woods, he'd noticed the earth had been disturbed. However, we know from Budemeyer's testimony, the surveyors, that the ground there wasn't freshly disturbed and that it just blended in with the natural surroundings. This could suggest that what Mr. S is describing is something he saw much closer in time to the actual burial, and that by the time he reported it and by the time Budemeyer went to the scene after the body was found, the dirt was no longer freshly disturbed.
This question comes from Sarah Elena. Her Twitter handle is @FoxyCoffeeQueen, and she asks, could you all elaborate a little more on what a Brady violation is? So Brady is actually a Maryland case that reached the Supreme Court, Brady versus Maryland. And what Brady says is we have the Due Process Clause. Due Process Clause says you can't take away a person's life, liberty, or property without due process. And the way the Supreme Court interpreted this clause in the Brady case was to say that regardless of a request by the defense, the state has an obligation to timely disclose material exculpatory evidence to the defense. And so when is evidence material exculpatory evidence? There's basically two definitions used by the court. The first is when that evidence creates a reasonable probability of a different outcome at trial. And the second is when the evidence undermines the confidence in the jury's verdict. And so in this case, we've discussed various witnesses who were interviewed, and yet we don't have their statements. And so imagine, for instance, that we have Anne, one of the witnesses we mentioned. Let's say that she gave a statement to police and said, I walked to the parking lot on January 13th and I saw Hay get into her car alone. Hypothetically speaking, if we were able to contact Anne and get that information, that's likely the type of evidence that would constitute a Brady violation because, again, the Brady case says that's material exculpatory evidence and the state had to turn that over to the defense.
And Colin, what happens if it's discovered that Brady material or this information that's exculpatory for the defense is later uncovered after a verdict's been rendered?
Brady was actually a case that dealt with evidence related to a sentencing hearing. And if it's only relevant to sentencing, there's a new sentencing hearing. If the evidence, on the other hand, like the hypothetical I gave, goes to the guilt or innocence of the suspect, then in that case, a new trial is ordered. And because Brady evidence is evidence that was never disclosed to the defense, it's always something that can be raised even now over a decade later. And so if we were able to uncover evidence that the state failed to disclose and it's material to Adnan's guilt or innocence, that would then lead to a new trial for Adnan.
Our next question comes from Thomas Ahern, whose Twitter handle is @MistExplorer. He writes, was the murder of Wanda Turner ever solved? Wanda Turner, just to recap from last week, was a woman who was murdered in 1998, and her body was discovered in Lincoln Park by Nicole's mom. Nicole is a friend of Jen's, and according to Jen, in her very first interview, was the one who informed Jen that Hay had been strangled. Wanda Turner's murder was never solved. It remains an open case. There's very little material out there on what happened to her, just a few news articles. And as far as I'm aware, there was never even a suspect identified in her death. Unfortunately, she's not the only woman who, in the 98-99 timeframe, who was found dead in Lincoln Park, and whose case was never solved or never seemed to even have any leads. Another woman named Novella Brown was found in Lincoln Park in November of 1998. And again, a little bit of news coverage, but not much, and the case was never solved. Or in the case of Jada Lambert, were only solved years later with the help of DNA testing.
This Twitter question slash statement comes from Herman Middleman. His Twitter handle is at Herman Middleman. And he tells us, Shalom Rabashkin was actually denied bail partially based on his Jewish identity. And so Herman is referencing what I said last episode about the Samuel Sheinbein case. First, let me issue a correction. That case was a murder in Silver Spring and not Baltimore. But that's the case that I mentioned with the law of return that allows people who are Jewish to become citizens of Israel. And my argument was that the Jewish American community wouldn't stand for the state using that law of return to argue in support of detention of someone based upon them being a flight risk. And so that takes us to Mr. Rabushkin. He was a CEO of a kosher slaughterhouse, and he was initially charged in connection with getting illegal workers' false documentation. Now, after he was charged, he was actually given pretrial release based upon an appearance bond, an ankle bracelet, and turning in his passport. But then while he was released, he was arrested again for bank fraud. And when he was arrested, they did a search of his house. And that search found $20,000 in cash and an additional passport in a bag. And the state used those facts plus the law of return to argue he's a flight risk and he should be detained. What actually happened, though, is after that, as sort of I was guessing last episode, several members of the local Jewish community protested. They sent letters to their local representative. Arguments were made to the appellate court. And based upon that, the appellate court reversed and they actually gave release to Mr. Rabushkin. And if I'm reading from the court's opinion here, it is the undersigned's view that the parties have placed far too much emphasis in their briefing over Israel's law of return. It is undisputed the defendant would be entitled to Israeli citizenship were he to flee to Israel. While the availability of foreign citizenship might theoretically make defendant more likely to flee to Israel, just as if any other citizen were entitled to claim citizenship in a foreign country, there is absolutely no evidence defendant has any ties to Israel or has made any preparations to flee to Israel. Based on the particular circumstances of this case, defendant is not a de facto dual citizen as the government alleges. And so that's a pretty good counterpoint of a case where the state tried to use the law of return, and based upon a good deal of pressure, that decision was reversed and it was deemed by the appellate court to be improper to use his nationality and his religion to argue against his pretrial release.
And again, I'm not sure how much we touched on this last week, but bail is available in first-degree murder cases. So the idea that, well, perhaps the state shouldn't have made those arguments, but in the end it's all moot, because he wouldn't have gotten bail anyway. No, that's not true. Bail was very much available for first-degree murder cases and had been given in similar circumstances where this he could flee the Pakistan argument had not been made.
Yeah, and the judge actually, in that reopened hearing when Vicky Wash made the statements about him being a flight risk, that judge said, the day before this hearing, I released a murder suspect in his own recognizance, meaning he didn't even have to post a bond. So not unusual at all, especially in a case where the defendant has no priors. And again, as we discussed before, there's not a named witness. Jay was unnamed. He was not disclosed to the defense. That's a strong argument in favor of release because the state didn't produce compelling evidence of guilt.
At trial, the prosecution argued that the cell phone records corroborated Jay's story and that they could use the cell phones to track Adnan's movements, call by call, tower by tower, through the course of January 13th, 1999. But that's not what AT&T told them. Next week on Undisclosed.
A special thanks to Ramiro Marquez for our theme music and photography, to Christy Williams for our website, to Baluki, who designed our logo, and to Amar Naji, our sound editor. Our executive producer is Dennis Robinson. You can find us online on social media, on Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @UndisclosedPod. Tweet us your questions and comments using the hashtag Undisclosed.
The Undisclosed Podcast is brought to you in part by the Adnan Syed Trust, a legal defense fund that helps to pay Adnan's legal fees and associated investigative efforts. All proceeds raised through advertising on today's episode of Undisclosed were given to the trust. To learn more about the trust and to donate to our efforts to free Adnan, please visit www.launchgood.com/freeAdnan.